So this week for our QI, virtual QI seminar, we're very happy to have Mehdi Solomanafar from MIT, who's going to be telling us about some exciting results on partition functions for quantum antibody systems. So if you're ready, please get started.
All right, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. And it's great to virtually join you. So I'll talk about a joint work with Aram Haru and Saeed Mehrban, which involves different questions about quantum antibody systems at finite temperature. So at first, these questions might look unrelated to each other, but during this talk, hopefully I'll tell you that these are actually closely related questions. So let me first tell you more about the setup. So we have n qubits or spins arranged on a lattice whose interactions are described by a local Hamiltonian, which is some of terms like hi. Such that each one of these terms act on a spatially local region. But this Hamiltonian has a spectrum, certain energies and eigenstates. And in particular, if at zero temperature, you look at the system, you find it to be in its ground state with energy E naught. So in physics, we would like to estimate this energy and have efficient algorithms that given a Hamiltonian tells us about the ground energy. So then naturally we can ask how hard is it computationally to approximate the ground state energy in the worst case. And as you might know, this is a QMA complete problem. But there are efficient algorithms for special cases of this problem. For example, by a result of Rod et al., we know that if the lattice is a 1D chain and the Hamiltonian is gapped, then there is a polynomial time algorithm for estimating the ground state energy. Or by a result of Brandao and Haru, we know that if the lattice is dense, meaning that each of these qubits or spins is interacting with almost all other spins, then there is a polynomial time algorithm for estimating the ground energy up to a constant error. There are also other algorithms for other restricted cases, but this talk is not about zero temperature. It's about when the system is at a finite temperature. So in particular, if the temperature is T, that we usually work with its inverse denoted by beta here, then you don't find the system to be in its ground state anymore. It's in a mixed state known as the Gibbs or thermal state. So this state is a combination of different eigenstates. Each of these eigenstates appear with a exponential weight, which is exponentially small in the energy of that eigenstate. So we often normalize this state, and we call the normalization factor the partition function of the system, which is basically some of these exponential factors that you can neatly write as trace of e to the minus beta times the Hamiltonian of the system. So if you take the limit of beta going to infinity, meaning at very low temperatures, the Gibbs state just approaches the ground state. And if you're looking at the system in the limit of beta going to zero, meaning at very high temperatures, then the Gibbs state is basically maximally mixed state. So these spins are distributed uniformly at random. So this partition function is not just merely a normalization factor. It encodes many useful statistical properties of the system. So for example, if you have the partition function, you can find its log, which gives you something which is proportional to the free energy of the system. So free energy has a energy term, this trace H rho, and an entropy term. And if you look closely, you see that, again, at low temperatures, meaning when beta goes to infinity, this free energy approaches the ground state energy. So in other words, free energy is a natural analog of ground state energy in the finite temperature case. So free energy is not the only quantity that you can read from partition function. From the derivatives of the partition function, you can also find other quantities. So again, similar to what we had in the zero temperature case, we would like to estimate various properties of the system at finite temperatures. But since most of them can be found from the partition function, we just focus on finding efficient algorithms for getting this partition function. So doing this
maybe one question
is intractable. Sure.
Maybe one quick quick question. Are you assuming unique ground state in the previous slide?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for simplicity, I assume unique ground state, but in the rest of the talk, I basically don't need that. All right, so finding the partition function exactly is a sharply hard. This is like a well-known result. So the goal that we have here is to design approximation algorithms. By that, I mean we want an algorithm that as input takes the Hamiltonian of the system, the inverse temperature beta, and an error parameter epsilon, and it outputs and estimate z hat for the partition function, which gives you an epsilon additive, which the log of z hat gives you an epsilon additive error to the log of the partition function. So in other words, you get an epsilon additive error to the free energy, or if you don't like it that way, you get an epsilon multiplicative error to the partition function itself. So this is the goal that we have here. And then again, you might ask, what is the hardness of finding such algorithms? We know that in the exact case it's sharply hard. How about this approximate version? So often in the rest of the talk, I assume this error to be inverse polynomial. And it turns out the hardness of achieving such approximation depends on the temperature that you want to evaluate the partition function at. So to see this, let's again look at what happens when we vary the temperature. So at very high temperatures, the Gibbs state is just maximally mixed state. So finding the partition function is trivial in that case, since it's just the dimension of the system. And at low temperatures, we saw that free energy approaches the ground state energy. So estimating the partition function becomes QMAR.
Actually, quick question. Why do we want, sure. Is there any reason specifically why we're using the free energy
Right, so
is that like the, why are we defining the error or the goodness of approximation in terms of the free energy?
So partition function is a very large quantity. It's like exponentially big. It could be exponentially big. So you usually want a multiplicative error when you deal with that like large quantities. So if you take the log of that, then that means a natural like error that that you would like to have is additive error. So this is like similar to ground state energy. When we want to estimate it, we demand like a epsilon additive error. Free energy is just, you can think of it basically similar to the ground state energy. Right, so but this, we see that as you change the temperature, the hardness of approximating the partition function changes from being trivial to basically being QMA hard. But in physics, we know about another transition as we change the temperature, which is a transition in the phase of the system. So during phase transition, physical properties of the system abruptly change. So for example, if you have a ferromagnetic system, at low temperatures, all the spins are aligned in the same direction. So if you add over their individual magnetic moment, you get a non-zero net magnetization. But at high temperatures, their distribution is random. So you get a zero net magnetization. So you might expect as you change the temperature, you go from zero to some non-zero value, like gradually. But what happens is that the magnetization remains zero from like infinite temperature all the way to some critical value. And then suddenly it jumps to some non-zero value and saturates at low temperature. So this point that your magnetization abruptly changes the phase transition point, and it kind of separates your phase into two parts, the disordered phase, as they call it, and an ordered phase. This is not only about ferromagnetic system. You can see this in many other material and Hamiltonians. And this motivates this question that whether hardness of approximating the partition function has anything to do with this physical phenomena of phase transition. Because as we see, both suddenly change as you vary the temperature. So this, sure.
Usually in a system, there can be a sequence of transitions when you know at the temperature.
Right, so here I'm just assuming the first one that you encounter as you go from infinite temperature to lower temperatures. So there might be other things happening after like the first time you see such transitions, but I'm neglecting those things.
Uh-huh. But there's only one transition in the computational hardness, or are there many?
So we know that, let me tell you the thing that I want to say in this slide. I think that clarifies your question.
Mm-hmm.
So this question that whether phase transition and hardness of approximation are related or not has been proven to be the case for a classical icing model, where it's shown that above the phase transition temperature, there is a polynomial time algorithm for estimating, say, the partition function. And below this point, there is no efficient algorithm unless NP equals RP. So it's basically NP hard to find such an approximation. So I guess from the computational perspective, you just divide the temperature range into two parts. Some part is where you can find efficient algorithm and some part that it's NP hard. So there aren't like multiple things going on.
And this is also just for this particular model.
This particular model, right?
Yeah.
But in the rest of the talk, I'll try to like talk more generally.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, for this this specific classical icing model, the computational phase transition is it matches the physical phase transition. In the rest of the talk, I'll tell you about the quantum version of this question. And to do that, I need to tell you more about the phase transition. So there are at least two ways to study it. One is based on the location of the complex zeros of the partition function, and one is based on the decay of correlations in the system. So as I said, these relate to finding approximation algorithms for the system. And at first, they kind of seem unrelated to each other. One is about computational hardness. One is about the properties of the system at complex temperatures, which may look unphysical because we usually restrict ourselves to real temperature. So before going on, let me give you an overview of the results that we have. So first I'll tell you how from the first way of thinking about the phase transition, we can actually get an algorithm. Which results in a quasi-polynomial time algorithm for all inverse temperatures less than some critical value. So it's desirable to actually find this phase transition point. And for general Hamiltonian, this is a hard problem. So in our second result, we give a lower bound on that. And then I tell you about the other way of characterizing the phase transition in terms of exponential decay of correlations, and how this is related to the complex zero version, and they're kind of two sides of the same coin. So we show how you can get from one to the other in quantum systems, and we also have a result for the converse just for classical systems. So I'll tell you in more details about all this, but let me first go into more details about the complex.
Quick question that was entered into the chat. So the question is, isn't it easy to approximate exactly the partition function of the Ising model at zero temperature?
So that depends on the whether you're assuming ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic Ising model. So if you have a ferromagnetic, then just the state of the system is clear and all the spins are in the same direction. But if you have an anti-ferromagnetic system, it can be computationally hard.
So I don't mind to clarify the question. If the person who asked it, yep, okay. He said thanks. All right.
Okay, cool. So let me tell you more about the complex zero. So again, as I mentioned, at the phase transition point, we see that certain physical properties of the system show some non-differentiable behavior, or if you look at quantities like free energy, you see singularities or non-analytic behavior. So if you just look at the real temperature, it's kind of hard to see what's going on and why you get such behavior at all. But things become clearer if you look at the complex inverse temperature plane. So again, if we just restrict ourselves to the real data, things are as usual. The partition function is just sum of strictly positive terms because each of these e to the minus beta EKs are strictly positive. So in particular, the partition function never is zero. And when you take its log to get free energy, for example, you don't hit any singularities or nothing weird happens. But this changes if you go to the complex plane. Now, for certain complex data, your partition function can become zero. And this is because these exponential factors, e to the minus beta ek, they pick up a phase. And when you add them together, these phases might cancel each other. So the partition function might just be zero. And if you change the number of particles, the number and location of these zero changes. And in particular, in the limit of the number of particles going to infinity, some of these zeros accumulate and approach the real axis, and they get closer and closer to a specific point on the real axis, which is our critical value beta c. So if you look at the partition function at this point, it's getting smaller and smaller, so its log becomes singular. And then from that, you can read other quantities, and you see that they also show weird behavior. So this tells us that the location of the complex zeros of the partition function can give us insight into why phase transition happens and where it actually occurs. So a study of these zeros was initiated by Li and Yang back in the 50s. They had a slightly different context. It was a classic, their system was a classical Ising model. And instead of varying the temperature to get a phase transition, they changed the external magnetic field. But this was later extended to thermal phase transition, as I had in the previous slides, by Fisher. And therefore, the zeros that I showed you in the previous slides are often called Fisher zeros. Okay, so to recap, we've made two observations so far. One is that as we lower the temperature from high temperatures to beta goes to infinity, the partition function goes through a transition from being easy to estimate to being hard to estimate. And then we saw that at least for specific models like Ising model, this is related to a physical phase transition, and we can characterize this phenomena using the complex zeros of the partition function. So the natural question here is if we can actually do this for quantum many-body systems, meaning we use these zeros to somehow find algorithms for the partition function. So this is our first result. So recall that our goal is to find an algorithm that gives an epsilon additive error to the log of the partition function. And what we achieve is such an algorithm that runs in time n to the order log n over epsilon. And it works for all temperatures above the phase transition, meaning all beta is less than the critical value. So in particular, if you choose this epsilon to be inverse polynomial, then the running time is just n to the order log n, which is a quasi-polynomial. So let me tell you what the algorithm is and how we analyze it. So the idea is very simple. You start from the high temperature regime where finding the partition function is easy. And then we use the solution there and extrapolate the answer to find the solution in the harder regime, meaning at lower temperature. And by extrapolation, I simply mean to tailor expand the log of the partition function. So this is like a very simple idea, but in order to make sure it actually works, you need to first show that you can find the Taylor, you can compute the Taylor expansion, meaning you can compute the low order derivatives. But more crucially, you need to make sure that the Taylor expansion converges, because if you're outside the radius of the convergence, then you basically, this doesn't work. And this convergence criteria is when the connection to those complex zeros appear. So let's again look at this distribution of these zeros in the complex plane. If you're starting from beta equals zero, where temperature is infinity, and we are extrapolating the answer all the way to some beta, which is crucially less than the critical value where these zeros are accumulated. So if that's the case, all the zeros before this point, they're constantly far away from the real axis. So they're not approaching the real axis as n goes to infinity, and they're far away. That means we can find a region like this that includes both the starting point and the end point, such that there are no zeros inside it. And the edges of this region are constantly far away from all these complex zeros. So we call this the zero-free region. And based on definition, the log of the partition function, therefore, is analytic in this zero-free region. And from this, we see that the Taylor expansion of the log also converges, right? But this is not the only thing we need. We need to assume not only the partition function is non-zero inside the zero-free region, but also it's lower bounded by some exponentially small value. So that when you look at its log, the log is upper bounded by order n. So if you have these constraints, then you can Taylor expand the log of the partition function at beta equals zero and just keep the first k term. And then we know from the Taylor's theorem that the error from this approximation is just simply exponentially small in the number of terms that you've kept in the approximation, times the magnitude of the function that you're expanding, which is order n here. So we want this error to be inverse polynomial. Therefore, we need to keep the first order log n derivatives in the Taylor expansion. And now the question is, how do we find these derivatives, right? So I don't go through the details, but you can show that finding the derivatives of the log of the partition function is equivalent to just finding the derivatives of the partition function itself. In other words, if you have the derivatives of z beta, then you can solve a system of equations and find the derivatives of the log. And the derivatives of the partition function at beta equals zero are very simple. They're proportional to the trace of h to the k for the kth derivative. So h is just sum of polynomially many local terms. Therefore, h to the k is also sum of polynomially many terms. But now the number of those terms has increased, this n to the order k. And this is just the only bottleneck in computing these derivatives. So it takes time n to the order k to find the trace h to the k, or since k is order log n here, it just takes time n to the order log n to find all these derivatives, and therefore estimating the partition function. So yeah, this is like a very simple idea. I guess the only subtlety here is that we are not Taylor expanding the partition function itself. We are Taylor expanding its log. Therefore, this knowledge of where the zeros are located, it helps us to get a good bound on the approximation error. And this doesn't appear if you just Taylor expand the partition functions. This is just Taylor expanding some exponential function that is always analytic. So at this point, you might be wondering why we stopped before the phase transition. So why don't we just take the end point to be after this critical point where zeros are close to the real axis. So remember that for this algorithm to work, we need to make sure that there is a zero-free region that includes both the starting point and the final point. And if you insist on doing that when beta is past the phase transition point, you need to somehow pass through these like this armor of zeros near the critical point. And therefore, you need to somehow squeeze your zero-free region to get over that. And I didn't include the dependency on the width of this region in my previous slides, but it basically, the running time blows up if you try to like somehow squeeze it to pass the zero. So as the number of particles increases, these complex zeros get closer and closer around the phase transition.
So maybe there's a question from David Mayer that I would have expected the Taylor series only to converge up to a radius around zero, at which the closest zero in any direction appears. Either David could ask this question himself, or if you understand the question, you could answer.
Right. So I'll tell you more about that that setup later. But you can basically use maps to map this rectangular region to a disk and then Taylor expander. So what really matters here is it's not the shape of this region. It's important to not have any complex zeros around it. So there are things called conformal mapping that takes care of that part. I don't know if I answered the question or not.
Yeah, he'll wait for the part of the talk. I have a question as well. So are you going to tell us how do you prove that the width is order one in this region?
Right, so yeah, I'll describe that soon, but you can kind of think of this as the definition of phase transition, that I'm saying as long as you have this zero free region, we say that you are in the ordered phase, or as they call it, where the partition, where the system is in the uniqueness region. So I don't get into those results, but basically this algorithm works as long as this criteria that I mentioned holds. So then the question is, if we can prove such thing exists at all, and I'll get to that in a second.
And are you going to say more about why the running time blows up? Like if I had like a very detailed knowledge of where all the complex zeros were, you might imagine I could, you know, construct some for like some specific system, construct some zero-free region in this way.
Yeah. So I didn't include the dependency on the width of this region in the previous slide, but it basically exponentially depends on that. So by width, I mean the closest distance to this zero. So it doesn't matter how like the rest of your zero-free region look like. As long as you have a bottleneck where zeros get very close, the running time blows up. And this is just basically because of that conformal mapping that I mentioned, that you need to have a map that kind of takes this weird shape and put it inside a nice disk. And if you have these bottlenecks, that map doesn't work anymore. Right. So, I guess this slide shows that at least why our algorithm fails to go beyond the phase transition point. But as I mentioned earlier, this is in general NP hard to do. So any other algorithm that you also consider for other reasons, it breaks at this point. So this idea of Taylor expanding the log of a combinatorial object was introduced by Barbinok recently. And instead of partition function, he used it to compute the permanent of matrices. And since then, it's been used in to find new algorithms for many old counting problems. And the running time of these algorithms are often quasi-polynomial time. But on the other hand, they're deterministic. So usually in combinatories, people used to work with sampling algorithms or Markov chain Monte Carlo method that are randomized. But this is like a nice nice way to find deterministic algorithms. So if you do more work, you can improve the running time just to polynomial time, and people have done it after our work. So at least at high temperature regime, you can improve this quasi-polynomial running time to just polynomial. So the tools that that are used in this these improvements are something that we also use, and I'll describe next. So this is our second result that, as I mentioned, we would like to find the critical inverse temperature beta C where this algorithm stops working. But for a general Hamiltonian, exactly locating these zeros and finding these locus is hard. So what we do is that we give a lower bound on this value. So instead of this rectangle that goes all the way to the actual phase transition point, what we show is a disk that there exists a constant beta naught such that if you consider a disk of that radius, there is no zero inside. And this beta naught depends on the geometric properties of the Hamiltonian, like the degree of the interaction graph and the norm of each individual term. So let me tell you how we get this, we establish the analyticity inside this disk. So it's based on recursively lower bounding the partition function using a well-known tools in physics called cluster expansion. So we use a version by Hastings. And our goal is to lower bound the partition function of n qubits, right? But let's first consider a subset of size L and remove all the terms in the Hamiltonian that are not acting on these on this subset. And then we call the partition function of this subset Z sub L. And we ask what happens if we add a new qubit to the system. So then the new partition function is just Z sub L plus one. And we show that inside that disk, the new partition function is lower bounded by some constant times the previous partition function. So now if you repeat this argument a bunch of times, you see that the partition function of the whole system is lower bounded by some exponentially small value times the partition function of just one qubit. So the partition function of one qubit itself is lower bounded by a constant. Therefore, this shows that inside that disk, your partition function is non-zero, and also it's lower bounded by some exponentially small number. So when you look at the log, this just means that your log is less than order n. So this this finding is the same thing that I mentioned earlier, that for this algorithm to work, we need to find this zero-free region that also has this additional constraint. So for classical spin models, you don't need this because the partition function there is a polynomial. And just assuming that there are no zeros around the zero-free region suffices. But here we somehow need to include this other constraint, which I showed you how to get. All right, so how do we actually show this relation between the partition function after we add a new qubit? This is where we use the cluster expansion. So it turns out as long as your beta is inside that disk that I showed you, you can express the e to the minus beta h operator as a specific sum, which is sum of products of the local interaction terms hi. So this way of writing the exponential function allows you to write the trace of the partition, the trace of e to the minus beta h after you add a qubit in terms of the bond before you add. So you basically find out what is the contribution of just adding a single qubit. And then we show that these corrections are small. And if you think about it, this just proves the thing that I stated. So if your temperature is above sorry, if your beta is above that constant beta knot, that this cluster expansion was derived for, then you basically can't establish the convergence of this expression here. And then like these ideas don't work. So it's nice to come up with another way of driving this, but that's what we should. Right, so this was our second result that as I said, it gives a lower bound on the critical point where this algorithm breaks. Now let me tell you about the other way of talking about the phase transition, which is in terms of the decay of correlations. So by that, I mean we have our Gibbs state and we are measuring two observables. So these observables are at some distance from each other. And when we say the Gibbs state has exponential decay of correlation property, I just mean if you look at the correlation between these two observables, which is defined in terms of this covariance here. If this is exponentially small in the distance of the particles, then we say we have the decay of correlation property. So the decay of correlation is also a signature of the phase transition. It's like a physically well-known thing. In particular, above the phase transition point, we know that we have the disordered phase where correlations decay exponentially. And below the phase transition point, we might have long range order where this may not.
So below the phase transition, below the TC, are you looking at the connected correlation function or disconnected correlation function?
So I guess by TC, I mean the temperature at which for the first time the exponential decay of correlation stops holding. And by that, I just basically mean this criteria here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, please go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So then you might wonder whether this different way of thinking about the phase transition has also has algorithmic implications. So in a beautiful line of work, this has been established for, again, classical spin systems, where it's shown that mixing in time is equivalent to mixing in a space. So by mixing in space, I just mean the exponential decay of correlations hold. And by mixing in time, I mean there are sampling algorithms like Markov chain Monte Carlo, whose mixing time is fast, or basically have efficient sampling algorithms. So it's been proved that if this is the case, the mixing times are short, then it has to be the case that the correlations in the system decay exponentially. And vice versa, if your Gibbs state has this correlation decay property, then you can find efficient algorithms for the system. So this has been also studied for quantum Hamiltonians. And Brandao and Castoriano have established one direction of this equivalence for commuting Hamiltonian. They've also shown that for general Hamiltonians, if you add another constraint, which is the decay of quantum conditional mutual information, which gives you something known as the Markov property, then again, you can find algorithms, sampling algorithms. So in the quantum case, by sampling algorithms, we mean a quantum circuit that prepares the Gibbs state efficiently. And then you can just sample from the outcome of the quantum circuit. So they show that if you both have the decay of correlations and then decay of quantum CMI, then such quantum circuits exist. So as you see, a different way of talking about the phase transition also results in algorithms. And it makes you wonder, what is the relation between these two notions? Whether complex zeros and decay of correlations are basically describing the same phenomena or not. So for translationally invariant classical systems, this has been proven in a seminal work of Dobroshin and Schlossman. And in our work, we considered the quantum version of this question again. So we managed to show one direction of this for a quantum system, which is our third result. And it says that suppose we have this zero free region that we had before. And suppose you have, you're looking at an inverse temperature inside this zero free region. Then this implies that at that temperature, the Gibbs state has the exponential decay of correlations property, right? And we show this when you have a quantum system and your observables are at least logarithmically far from each other. But then we can also improve this to when your observables are just constantly far away from each other. So we get rid of this log n when the Hamiltonian consists of a commuting term. Or when you have a general Hamiltonian, but on a one-dimensional chain. So in either of these cases, you can just see that if you don't have zeros, then you have the decay of correlation. And let me tell you how we prove this. So we start by defining a function, which basically measures the correlation between the observables A and B. And this happens at a specific inverse temperature beta. So this function is different from that covariance form that I had on previous slides. And it's designed to have specific properties. So I don't go through the details of what it is, but you can just think of it as a measure of correlation between A and B. But we know that if this one is small, then the previous conventional way of describing the correlations, that's also small. So without loss of generality, we were gonna work with this one. And we show at beta equals zero, this function is zero. So in other words, at infinite temperature, there is no correlation between your observables. And this makes sense because then your Gibbs state is just a maximally mixed state and the spins are uncorrelated. So this is a natural. But not only that, we show that the derivatives of this function are zero. If you consider the first, second, and third derivatives all the way up to something which scales with the distance between the observables that you're measuring their correlations. So the further apart from each other the observables are, the more of the derivatives of this function are zero. And this means around beta equals zero, this function looks very flat. And we also show that if your beta is inside that zero free region, then this function is also analytic. So in other words, the analyticity of the partition function implies the analyticity of this specific function that, that we are considering. So adding these together, then you can use tools from complex analysis to show that if your function is very flat and it's almost zero, it's zero at a small beta, then it can't grow too much when your beta is some constant. The function remains small. So this analyticity kind of pushes your function to remain small. And since this function encodes the correlation between your observables, that just means the correlations are also small and they're indeed exponentially small in the distance. So that's the proof of one direction of this this equivalence that I described. We can't establish the other direction for a quantum system, but we have some results for classical spin systems. So this direction asks for the following. We know that at some real inverse temperature beta, the correlations decay exponentially. And we want to show that around that real point, if you look in the complex plane, there are no zeros located. So as I mentioned earlier, this has been proven for translationally invariant classical systems before. What we do is just to generalize this to general classical system. So the proof is kind of complicated, and I don't go through the details. The rough high-level idea is similar to our second result, where we analyze what happens when you add a new qubit to your partition function, how much it changes. And instead of using cluster expansions as we had in that result, we use the decay of correlations here. So this is kind of subtle because the decay of correlations is a property of real betas, but what we are interested here is to bound the value of the partition function for complex betas. So then you need to be careful how you work with this. And what we basically show is that the contribution of the single spin that you've added is decoupled from the contribution of the spins in this red subregion that are far away from this spin. So this one, whatever it's doing to the partition function when you add it, you can kind of forget about how it correlates with the spin further away. But this kind of gives you a handle on how you can work with this. But the proof is actually more complicated than I think. I will go through that. All right. So by these results, I guess I showed you how two different ways of thinking about the phase transition are related to each other, and then how you can get algorithms from looking at the complex zeros of the partition function. So this idea of extrapolating extrapolating your solution to find the solution somewhere harder need not to be restricted to temperature. You can extrapolate in other parameters. And we also do that. And we extrapolate in the external magnetic field. So before I change the temperature and I said, okay, we start from the easy regime, we go to the hard regime. But now let's fix the temperature and instead look at some external magnetic field that is affecting these spins. So there, the easy regime is when this magnetic field is very strong, and then these spins are all aligned in the same direction. So this is where we can easily analyze the partition function and find the answer. And we want to use that to find a solution where this external magnetic field is just some small value. So now the interaction between spins also matter, and this makes things complicated, right? So for example, you can think about the ferromagnetic Heisenberg model, or I guess this is called XXZ model. So it's this specific Hamiltonian where you have some terms like ZI, ZJ, and XI, XJ, YI, YJ, which encodes the interaction between neighboring spins. But you also have this ZI term, which describes the interaction with the external magnetic field. So I add a parameter mu, where I encode the strength of the magnetic field inside that that parameter. And as I said, we now fix the temperature and we change mu to see what happens. So we look at the complex mu plane this time. The hard regime is where this mu is small. The easy regime is where it's large. And as before, just Taylor expand from large mu to some constant. So again, to find the quasi-polynomial time algorithm by that method due to Barbinock that I mentioned before, the only thing we need to take care of is to make sure that there are no zeros on our way. So it turns out that the location of the zeros for this family of Hamiltonians is on the imaginary axis. So there are no zeros on our way. And this has been proven by Suzuki and Fisher by mapping this Hamiltonian to a classical spin model and taking care of the zeros there. So this this is an example of Liang zeros that I mentioned earlier. And what we had before for beta plane was called Fisher zeros. Right, so this gives us a quasi-polynomial time algorithm for this Hamiltonian. And before, for a different model called ferromagnetic XY model, a polynomial time algorithm was known. So this Hamiltonian doesn't have that ZI, ZJ term. This is a result by Bravi and Gossett that they reduced the problem of estimating the partition function to counting the number of perfect matchings of a graph. So this problem is well studied classically, and there is a sampling algorithm for that by Jerome Sinclair.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
So in the previous slide, is the result applicable for any temperature or for some high temperature?
No, this is for any temperature.
Including zero temperature?
For any constant temperature.
Does it include zero temperature?
I mean, yeah. So at zero temperature, as I said, the ground state is easy to find. So so we don't have a hardness problem going to zero temperature.
But these are still complex zeros in the partition function, just as a function of this mu parameter at a constant real beta?
Correct. Correct.
Sorry? Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
By the way, previously you mentioned this relation between decay of correlation functions and phase transition. And I think you were mentioning the relation in the context of symmetry weaving transitions. Suppose you consider some transition that doesn't involve any symmetry weaving. What do you expect?
Right, so I guess it's kind of crucial for us to describe the phase transition in terms of these complex zeros. And we only work with the spin models. So as long as you have these two constraints, this framework works. But I don't know what happens if you have like weird phase transition. So perhaps there it's easier to think about the decay of correlations and get algorithms from that. Do you have a specific models in mind that you're asking?
There are many models. For example, in the toy code, if you just start from the toy code, it's one phase, and you can add some magnetic field term to drop it into other phase. There are also simpler examples in involving fermions, just free fermions. You can go from a trivial band to a chain band by going through a gapless Dirac point.
Right, so here I'm talking about thermal phase transitions, not quantum phase transitions. So you can assume that you are at zero temperature, and then, for example, in the Turing code or in the other example you mentioned, you change the magnetic field, and then you see a phase transition because the Hamiltonian becomes gapless, for example. So this framework doesn't apply there.
You mean it doesn't apply at zero temperature?
Right. So at exactly zero temperature, where you have quantum phase transition, not thermal phase transition, this framework that I've mentioned, it breaks. So I don't know how to fix it, but you can think about it in terms of this language.
Mm-hmm. even at finite temperature, there are examples in transitions involving gauge theories where the high temperature phase and the low temperature phase are different, but there's no symmetry breaking. The transition is driven by the proliferation of loops.
Sorry, say that again.
In some gauge theory, the in high dimensional gauge theory, like three dimensional gauge theory, at finite temperature, there's a finite temperature transition driven by proliferation of loops. That doesn't involve any symmetry breaking.
Right. So, yeah, as I said, I don't know how to apply this framework there. But it's certainly a good question.
I mean, I think in that case, the correlation function is probably just generalized from point-like ones to string-like or membrane-like, et cetera, right?
Right. So that's what I mentioned earlier, that if you think about correlations, then generalizing this to other phase transitions makes sense. So even for the zero temperature case where in different phases you have exponential decay of correlations and when your Hamiltonian is gapless, then this doesn't hold anymore. You can still recover some aspect of this connection between algorithms and phase transition. But if you strictly think about complex zeros, I don't know how to apply to that.
I would suggest instead of thinking of the complex zero, you can think of the singularity in the ground state energy density.
Right. So, yeah, I think this is related to a similar question, which is. So I talked about how we use this method to approximate the partition function. But you can think about adiabatic algorithms, which is you start with the Hamiltonian and then you're at zero temperature and then you change the a parameter in the Hamiltonian on an adiabatic path to get to another Hamiltonian. So this seems like kind of similar to this extrapolation framework. And it might be the case that you can use that to simulate like that type of algorithm. Or in the context that you mentioned, maybe looking at the singularities of the other quantities, like what you said, might be a good point to start.
Thanks.
You're welcome. All right, so that's basically all I wanted to talk about. Let me just end with some open questions. So one is to just fully establish this connection between complex zeros and correlation decay. I showed you how you can get one direction, but the other direction is still open. And you can also think about not only proving that from absence of zeros near the real axis, you can get decay of correlations, but also show that you can get the decay of quantum conditional mutual information. So this is a quantity that classically doesn't appear, it's just basically zero. But in quantum systems, you get this non-zero quantum CMI, or the Markov property, as they call it. And we don't know at what temperatures this is small. There's a recent proof that shows that very high temperatures, this quantity also exponentially decays. But it would be interesting to see if above the phase transition point where these zeros are away from the real axis, we can kind of use the same proof strategy that we use for the decay of correlations to get the decay of this quantum CMI. And this is related to another question, which asks if there is a regime of parameters in the Hamiltonian, for example, some external magnetic field or a range of temperatures, that this extrapolation algorithm works, but we can't use quantum computers to prepare and sample from the Gibbs state. So if the answer to the two previous questions is affirmative, meaning by assuming that the zeros are away from the real axis, we can prove both the decay of correlations and the decay of quantum CMI, then this regime of parameters basically doesn't exist. Because by a result of Brandao and Castriano, it's been proven that quantum computers can prepare the Gibbs state as long as correlations and CMI decay. But it might be that there are like other parameters like external magnetic field that such thing holds for them. And it's also interesting to look for other applications of this extrapolation method. So for example, you can think about avoiding the sign problem. And you start from a region where you don't have a sign problem. You can just run sampling algorithms like Monte Carlo methods and find the partition function. And then you use the solution there and you extrapolate to the harder part, which is where there is a sign problem and you can just solve your problem. And as I mentioned earlier, you can also think about the zero temperature case where we have adiabatic algorithms. So it would be interesting to see if this extrapolation method can simulate this type of algorithms classically. And there are other applications for this Barbinux method that recently has been used to estimate the mean value of quantum circuits or finding the permanent of matrices that appear in Poisson sampling, but I'll skip those. And it's also interesting to see if there are algorithms based on convex relaxations for the partition function. So for the ground state, this has been studied. There are things, there's a family of algorithms based on SDP relaxations that estimates the ground energy, and it seems those can be lifted to find the partition function. It's interesting to basically find like a rigorous way of lifting the ground state energy results to the finite temperature case. All right, so with that, I thanks everyone, and thanks for listening.
All right, thank you very much. Let's all give our speaker a virtual clap. And are there any questions?
I have a question, but I'll let others ask.
Hi, Mehdi. I had a question in relation to your previous statement about maybe application for avoiding a sign problem.
Right.
I've been wondering if, I don't know if you're familiar with these quasi-probabilistic methods for simulating quantum circuits, which essentially are methods that, in spite of the sign problem, will you can classically simulate these quantum systems, even though they have a sign problem, but somehow you can quantify the magnitude of the sign problem and the classical runtime is exponential in this magnitude. It's called, referred to as the negativity of the circuits. So, in these kind of settings, sometimes when the system is kind of more mixed, the negativities kind of cancel and you get something that's positive enough that you can efficiently classically simulate them. And so I'm wondering if there's actually a kind of deep connection between these approaches and the quasi-probabilistic ones. And if you're aware of any connections.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not aware of any result in this direction, but I guess this method is very simple in its in the algorithmic form. All you need to have for this extrapolation to work is first to be able to locate these singularities so that you know that your Taylor expansion converges. And also you need to find the coefficients of your Taylor expansion efficiently. So as long as you have these things, then you're basically done. So it's interesting to see if this can be established for the example you mentioned, but I'm not aware of any work in this direction.
Great, thank you.
I have a question, actually. If unless Anurag wants to go.
No, please go ahead, Mike.
I have a question about what happens in 1D, actually. So, because I guess in 1D it's known that there should be no zeros of the no complex zeros of the partition function.
Right,
so,
right.
In your proof, is this like, I mean, can you explain this? Is there an explanation in easy terms of how it happens in your proof?
You mean to prove that there are no zeros for 1D, or?
As in, is it to see how in 1D, like your disk, you should be able to take the disk to be arbitrarily large, or?
Right. So I think just taking that result that we had on that disk, the cluster expansion as a black box, I think it still doesn't give you the result you mentioned for 1D.
Mm-hmm.
So it is still just it's just a disk of constant radius, but I think if you actually look at the proof and do better lower bounds and upper bounds, it covers all the all the constant temperatures on 1D2. So I think I don't have it on a slice to go through the details, but. The 1D case is a well-known and well-established result by Araki.
Mm.
So I think that the method differs from our cluster expansion, but I don't see a problem to just specialize our proof to 1D to show that there are no zeros.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. So my question is that for the third open question, do you expect there to be a direct sampling algorithm which does not go through the decay of correlation and decay of QC? Like, if there was a zero free region, could you directly extrapolate a sampling algorithm from, you know, infinite temperature case?
So your question is whether we can find a quantum circuit that samples from the given state but not use the decay of correlations and then CMI?
Like as long as there is a zero free region, you know, as long as your beta is within the zero free region, you could somehow, you know, extrapolate from there.
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. So I think the classically, people also talk about instead of quantum circuits, you have a sampling algorithm for the Gibbs state. But I think there, since this zero free region is known to be exactly captured by the decay of correlation parts, people use them interchangeably. So I don't know, like, even if classically there is a proof that avoids talking about correlation decays and solely depends on complex zeros and shows that the sampling algorithm converges fast. But it's an interesting question.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions for our speaker?
Yeah, I have one. So could you say a bit more about this conjecture, the second one, that the absence of zeros implies decay of quantum conditional mutual information?
Right. So, as I said, in the quantum many-body systems, there is this weird thing going on that if you divide your system, say, into three parts, A, B, C, and then you condition on the spins in the B part, and you look at the correlation between the A and C, this is generally non-zero. So classically, this is always zero, and it's called, so the Gibbs distributions are known to obey this criteria, and then therefore they sometimes called Markov fields. But in the quantum settings, we don't know exactly when these quantum CMI correlations are small. So we know in two cases that they're exponentially small. One is that when the temperature is higher than a constant. So that constant doesn't it's not equal to the phase transition point. It's just some constant similar to that beta zero that I had in my disk proof. And then one other part is when your lattice is just a 1D chain, then we know that, I think they, we know they decay sub-exponentially. But beyond that, we don't have an idea. So I was thinking if you can show that above the phase transition point, this is exponentially small. So in my slides, I described how we can use the absence of zeros to get the decay of correlations. So this was by defining a specific function that looks very flat and then it couldn't grow.
Right.
So it's interesting to see if a similar strategy can be used to show that quantum CMI is also small.
Okay, great, thank you.
Okay.
But what's the bottleneck there? I think panelists if you want to go.
So the bottleneck is that we kind of need a restricted version of this absence of zero. So I didn't go through the details in the talk, but even for the proving that the absence of zeros implies the decay of correlation, we need to assume not only that the partition function doesn't have zeros, but also if you project onto certain, if you fix the value of certain spins, which in the quantum language means you just project onto a specific state. So you take your Gibbs state and then you measure a part of it and then you post-select on some outcome of your measurement. So we demand that even after this projection, the partition function remains, it still doesn't have zeros or free energy remains analytic. So if you assume this, then we can prove the decay of correlations. And if you want to do the same thing with the quantum CMI, what you need is to assume this zero freeness when you condition on like non-local parts of the system. So you demand that your partition function doesn't have zeros, even if you apply weird projections onto the Gibbs state. So that kind of seems not to be a physical assumption. If you can, instead of doing that, just show that by projecting onto small regions, you can still show the decay of quantum CMI, then I think this is like a right direction to pursue.
Thanks.
And actually, maybe just a very naive question, but you used to get these bounds on the partition function, you used cluster, you described this cluster expansion technique you used. So I guess just from like basic complex analysis, right, we know like there are like very crude theorems, I guess, that if you know your analytic in some strip and like real on the real axis, that gives you some bound on like the modulus of a function in that strip. If I just throw these types of complex analysis statements of the partition functions, are they cruder bounds or?
I think the problem with that is that your partition function is some of these exponential coefficients. And that's like not a good way of thinking about it.
I meant the log of the partition function.
Yeah, sure. I mean, even the log. So the log of the partition function is, it depends on the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So we don't want to think about it that way. We want to somehow find a way that it looks at the locality of the system. So the Hamiltonian is sum of local terms, and you need to somehow look at the contribution of different qubits in the partition function. So if you have a tool that kind of ignores these locality constraints and wants to somehow generally apply a method to the partition function, they often give you like bad bounds. Like they're like too small or too large. So this cluster expansion is like a method that actually achieves this, that it allows you to probe what happens if I add one particle and like remove one particle. So that's why we use that. But I don't know if you have a particular idea, but I found this to be like the hard thing to achieve when working with partition functions, to find tools that take into account the locality of the system.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So are there any further questions? So if not, maybe let's all give Mehdi a virtual clap, and I guess we can end there. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.